Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Scottsdale Mayor-elect Lisa Borowski on density, housing, and the future of taser maker Axon.
And why marijuana is so cheap right now and what it means for the broader industry.
But first, there's been less controversy about the administration and results of last year's election than we've seen in the past couple of cycles. But in some circles, there's more controversy about the ability to get access to a key document from elections. It's called the cast vote record, and analysts say it's an important aspect of election transparency. Jen Fifield of VoteBeat has written about this and joins me now to talk more about it. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course. Thanks for being here. So what exactly is the cast vote record?
Basically, it's a giant spreadsheet that tells you by ballot what people voted for. It's an anonymous spreadsheet. The person's name or voter ID isn't on there. But if you look at each row, it'll say, you know, a vote for Lake, a vote for Trump, etc.
And why this is something that used to be, if not readily available, available for folks who wanted to, you know, try to do analyses of elections. But why has that changed?
So you're right. It used to be available 2020, 2022. Analysts were able to use it to say, for example, why Trump lost when other Republicans down ballot did great in their elections in 2020. And now counties are saying, well, we figured out that there's these concerns. State law may prevent us from giving it out. We think it does. And also there's voter privacy concerns that come up when releasing this record.
Does state law specifically preclude this document from being released?
Like everything in election law, it's a little vague. So it says you can't release the digital record of the ballot. But, you know, there's a debate about whether this data is a digital record.
Well, so let's talk about some of the different sides of that debate. For folks who say this should be released, what is their argument and for the benefit of it being released? And why do they say that it should be allowed to be released?
Well, basically, they say the more transparency, the better. Public records laws, you know, always should weigh voter and resident rights over any other concerns, unless there's a major concern of the state, unless you're going to somehow harm the state by giving it out. So there's a major just voter transparency argument here. But then when you look at the fact that you may be able to figure out small percentage of who people voted for, then that's when it gets kind of concerning.
Well, and is that the argument for folks who say this should not be released, that it could, in theory, be possible to figure out who somebody voted for?
Yes, that's definitely the main argument. So this is an anonymous record, but if you take it and you look at a very small precinct, say four people voted from a precinct, and you combine that with the record of votes cast, which does have people's names, you see four people, they all voted for the same candidate. Now you know exactly who they voted for. So in very select circumstances, there's a major voter privacy concern. Our ballots by nature under federal law have to be secret ballots.
So what are the possible outcomes here? I mean, is this something the legislature could try to clarify? Does it seem like there might be momentum to try to do that?
There is not a lot of momentum on these boring type election issues, right? And so I, you know, that's my job is to raise these boring issues. You know, they're not boring though, but there's not a lot of compromise happening in the state legislature for election law, other than that major bill that passed last year regarding the timeline, and they snuck some compromise in on smaller issues in that bill. Do I see that happening this session? Not really.
Well, and as you write about, like, this is one of the things that people would, in theory, be able to use this kind of data to figure out is how President-elect Trump won Arizona, but U.S. Senate candidate Carrie Lake did not. Is that sort of the kind of thing that analysts are saying, look, we're going to have a harder time, we're not going to be able to figure out without this specific data?
For the last election, definitely. That's the main thing they want to say, because there's still claims of how could Lake lose this election? in such a large way when Trump, you know, was a landslide across the state. And so they want to look by ballot. Now, we can look like by precinct or by party. We know that independents split their ticket. But if we want to look at the exact split ticket votes, saying, look at all of these, the number of Republicans or the number of voters who voted Republican down ballot, but then did not select Lake, that's the kind of thing we could see here.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there are other ways to sort of get at this information. It sounds like broadly there are, but maybe not at the same granular level, not the same level of specificity as what you would get in the cast vote record.
You're right. Yeah, you can look by party, for example. You can look by precinct, which is just like the neighborhood you live in. And you can look at both. You can look at your precinct by party as well. So you can get pretty granular. But I think the main thing here is for those people who don't trust elections, for giving them a way to see by ballot, these are the results that the machines tabulated. Now, obviously, there's a record that we shouldn't be making policy for that small percent of voters that don't trust elections, though.
Interesting. All right. That is Jen Fifield of VoteBeat. Jen, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Scottsdale's new mayor will take the oath of office later today. Lisa Borowski won November's election over incumbent Mayor David Ortega. Borowski had also run against Ortega in 2020 and says that race laid the foundation for this one. Scottsdale voters also elected new city council members this past fall, and observers say the city's newly constituted government will likely be more conservative than the previous one. The mayor and council members will have a number of issues to deal with, from housing and density to the future of Axon, the company that makes Taser stun guns. The outgoing mayor and council had approved an expanded campus for Axon late last year, including a new headquarters and apartments. But critics have reportedly collected enough signatures to refer the question to voters. The company's CEO last week canceled a planned groundbreaking on a new headquarters, citing that referendum and associated delays as a big reason. The firm also says it's looking at other locations across the country for that new HQ, potentially leaving Scottsdale altogether. I sat down with Mayor-elect Lisa Borowski recently. We should note this conversation happened just before Axon made its announcement last week. And we started with November's election. One of the narratives about the race, at least on the outside, was that it was in some ways a referendum on growth and development in Scottsdale. And I asked if that's how she saw it.
That was the headline, right? When I got in, that was the headline in 2020 also. And I think that was what people can look, feel, and see. That density is taking over, and it's a problem, and people are not happy with it. But the lesser known issue that I think was as big was the fiscal situation, mm-hmm. the spending, you know, the tax and spend approach to governance. And so, you know, when the details of all of the what I would describe as irresponsible spending or unaccountable spending came out, I think people were really focused on that as well. So it was a dual, you know, approach. And then, of course, the third prong of that, and I would say equally as big headline, was that residents felt like they were not being included in the process, not being listened to, being, you know, disregarded, and in some cases entirely dismissed. And so bringing residents back into city government in Scottsdale is a big, big issue.
Let me ask you about some of the budgeting and some of the fiscal issues, because obviously a lot of what you do is, as a city, is sort of things that people see every day. You know, you pick up the trash and you fix potholes, maybe not so much here as East Coast cities, but, you know, public safety, fire, things like that. Are you looking to reduce the city's budget? What are you looking to do in terms of budgeting and fiscal stuff?
So spending responsibly is the issue. When I was on council 2008 to 2012, we were climbing out of the Great Recession. So it was baptism by fire, the education that I received. It wasn't whether we wanted to cut spending. We had to cut spending. And so during my term, I led the charge with Mayor Jim Lane, and we established the Citizens Budget Commission. And they took a real deep dive into evaluating departmental spending, found efficiencies, found, you know, where we could cut wasteful spending, reined in the budget to the tune of 15%, which was significant, and we could have done more, but we didn't cut any services or reduce any amenities for citizens. So it can be done, and on my watch, ideally the first agenda item, one of the first ones we pass, will be to reestablish the Citizens Budget Commission and do that again.
Hmm. So on the issue of development, I know that there's a lot of questions, and we brought this up a little bit, in terms of like density and housing and apartments and high rises and, you know, where all this stuff should be. Parking, I know, is a big issue in parts of Scottsdale. What to you is the vision for what kinds of projects you would like to see breaking ground in your city going forward?
Well, based on that description of the question you've just asked, I'll start with residential, because development isn't just residential, mm-hmm. right? There are plenty of other development projects that come through the city. I want to restore a focus on high-quality development, and that does not mean it has to be more expensive. It just has to be commensurate with the environment, the landscape, the history of Scottsdale. The history of Scottsdale is not a bunch of high-rise apartments, and nor does anyone that I know, that I've encountered, very few people think that that's a good idea. We're not Tempe. We're not downtown Phoenix. We're not downtown San Diego. That's just not what our lifestyle is about. That's not why tourists from all across the world come visit us. So I think that really is diluting what makes us special. And so moving forward, I think we're good. We're maxed out on high-density rental communities. And so, you know, there's been a real push over the last 4 years. There's a big focus on being average, in my opinion. You know, we need to provide housing for everybody. We don't. We live in a city that is surrounded by a very expansive and diverse economically, and, you know, the products that are offered, the housing styles that are offered across the valley. So people can, you know, get to Scottsdale in 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever the case might be. So I think becoming every other city or a push to be average and accommodate everything and everyone, we welcome everyone, but I don't think we need to have housing that houses absolutely everybody.
So is that to say that there might just be some groups of people, some maybe socioeconomic levels, that just won't be able to live in Scottsdale?
No, it depends. I mean, during the campaign, you know, that came up, we need affordable housing. Well, I had a gal on my team, critical part of my campaign team, who is a realtor, right? And she would pull it up frequently, and she'd find properties that were, I don't know, at one point, you know, several hundred, 300 properties that were in the $350,000 range, you know? So it's misleading. I mean, there are a lot of areas of Scottsdale that cater to every economic, if you had two people in the residence, every economic base. So I think that's misleading.
One of the first issues that you and your new council members might have to be dealing with is a controversy over Axon in North Scottsdale. They have the big plan to build a new headquarter. They had housing and some other things they wanted to build up there. There's a group of people who don't like that plan that's looking to put it on the ballot to basically undo it. And now the CEO of Axon is saying they might have to look to build somewhere else and maybe go somewhere else. I'm curious what you make of all that.
Well, it's unfortunate. You know, certainly the city of Scottsdale is thrilled to have Axon in our community. And as mayor, I am thrilled to have them here. I hope they stick around. Their headquarters, when it was originally contemplated and came through when they purchased that state trust land piece, it did not include 1,900 apartments. And so the referendum, and I can attest to this, I obviously was not part of the referendum effort, but I can certainly attest to the fact that it is top priority on voters' minds about the high density. You know, I think the Axon project, the residential side of it, went too far, and I'm a firm believer in you should work with everything you've got and, you know, and try to come to a middle ground that diffuses the dispute. And that didn't happen.
Well, so in your role as mayor, how do you try to diffuse the situation? Because as you say, you're not supportive of their plans to expand their headquarters and put in residential and all the other stuff they were going to put in. But at the same time, you clearly want them to stay, which the CEO has said maybe they won't. So like, what's your role in trying to mediate this?
So to confirm, I am supportive of their plan for their headquarters. Very supportive.
Okay.
I think it could be an amazing campus. The problem lies solely in the 1,900 apartments, right, at that location or in any location that I can think of in Scottsdale.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is the mayor-elect of the city of Scottsdale, Lisa Borowski. Thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Great to speak to you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why monarch butterflies may finally make it onto the endangered species list and how people can help the insect thrive.
But first, Arizona's once booming marijuana market is in a big slump. And while it's good news for consumers who are paying a lot less these days, it's not good news for dispensaries or the tax revenue they bring in. It's happening for a few reasons, one of which could be on the docket at the state legislature this year. Unregulated, intoxicating hemp products that are being sold outside of dispensaries and do pretty much the same thing as what you can find inside. The Arizona Republic's Ray Stern has been covering it all, and I spoke with him more about it.
It's basically the biggest slump that they've had since the medical marijuana industry started back in 2010. The industry has been just been growing like gangbusters ever since then. Over time, of course, since the 2020 law, the medical numbers have gone down and the recreational has gone up because it costs money to get a medical card, and you don't need that anymore if you buy the recreational. So what has happened is during the summer, starting in July, there was just an unprecedented decline in the combined revenue, and it went below $100 million per month of combined revenue for the first time in basically recent years. There's been a lot of different factors, as we'll talk about, that that have just saturated the market with product, and supply and demand mean that if there's more supply, then the price is going to go down.
Right. So that's probably the first reason to talk about here, right, that this may be happening, which is that there seems to be a glut, like there's too much product.
Yes. And that's the number one reason that people are talking about for the decline, which, by the way, I'll just add, has been important for customers as well because it's meant to decline in prices. So I just wanted to add that.
Customers are getting a good deal right now.
It's been a bonus for them for sure. And that's probably going to stay that way because this oversaturation that's occurred with the product, it's happened in other states, too, because as the industry of this new, I mean, it's not really new anymore, but it's legal marijuana, which, of course, was not the case just 15 years ago. And so now these businesses have matured and cultivation is part of what they do. And they've done quite a bit of it. Here in Arizona, when we went to recreational, they allowed these existing medical dispensaries to have two licenses. Mm-hmm. And so you have lots of situations where the dispensary company themselves has a cultivation operation. Then they also lease out cultivation rights to others who have big cultivation operations. And then they sell the marijuana to maybe the dispensary that gave them the license, as well as other dispensaries around the state.
Okay, so lots of it being grown, basically.
And lots of them are doing this. Yeah. And so, so what I hear is that too many, you know, I mean, you know, I don't know if too many is the right phrase, but tons of them are doing this. Some people are not doing well. Others are doing great.
Yeah.
So, yes, this large supply has brought the price down.
Okay, so a couple of things happening there. Customers getting great deals. Dispensaries, not so much. Let's talk about the other reason that you wrote about here, that some people say there's a slump in the marijuana market, though, which is the hemp market, which is different. This is the same plant, a different strain of THC as marijuana. What is this? Explain.
Well, you have to get a little bit scientific here because there's this plant called Cannabis sativa. Everyone else knows it as marijuana, but Cannabis sativa is the plant, and there's lots of different strains. Hemp is a type of marijuana or type of this plant, basically, that contains very low THC. But with this 2018 Farm Bill that came around, and it had this loophole that basically allowed people to take the small, tiny amounts of the THC molecules that are in the hemp and just squeeze them out, concentrate them. You take a lot of hemp and you've got a lot of concentrate, and then what you get is this pure THC product. The typical psychoactive ingredient in marijuana is called delta-9 THC. Mm-hmm. Then there's other delta THCs like delta-8 and delta-10, and these are sometimes called weed light because they will get you high supposedly, but not very much. When people really started exploiting this loophole, the hemp had mostly been used to make CBD, which is considered to be like a healthful thing that people will make to put on their skin or maybe consume it to relieve pain, things like that.
You see it in skin creams, things like
right.
that. Yeah.
And this is basically just another one of these molecules that was taken out of this cannabis sativa plant and concentrated. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't get people high. It's not intoxicating.
Okay.
So when this farm bill passed, people realized, well, this contains a loophole that seems to suggest that we can produce these intoxicating products. So you've gotten to the situation where these Delta-9 products are very similar to regular marijuana products, but they don't have to adhere to the same state laws that the marijuana dispensaries have to. So people can order them online. You can find them at smoke shops. The age is 18 to buy them. And that's just actually the age that the smoke shop might put on them because there's absolutely no regulation for these products right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the marijuana dispensaries say that it's putting a major dent in their sales, although exactly what that dent is, nobody can say because people can not go to a dispensary and still get basically the same product. I just wrote a story about how Total Wine and Beer, which is one of the country's largest alcohol retailers, just started introducing these products into their stores across the country.
THC-infused drinks.
There's no alcohol in it because there's a federal law that says you can't mix alcohol and some other substance. But what they can do is offer people, and they have actually like a whole shelf or actually a whole like part of an aisle that's dedicated to many different brands. They're all from out of state. There are some states where these hemp products have been regulated. They're tested very well, and then they're shipped here. The products have usually about 10 milligrams of THC, delta-9, per serving. But the lack of regulation means that they could put a lot more in there if they wanted to. If they wanted to. So the dispensaries, they do sell low THC drinks like Total Wine is selling. With 10 milligrams. They also sell 100 milligram drinks that will definitely get people really high. So we may see Total Wine and others start to do that just because there's demand for it and there's no reason they shouldn't do it.
Right. So you said regulated, sometimes tested in other states, these products. But here they're unregulated. The AG actually said here that they're illegal here at some point.
Right. This is where it gets really legally complicated for people. And it kind of reminds me of the Wild West back in the old days in like the late 2000s where people were saying, well, no, we can sell marijuana under these laws. And the feds and other people are saying, no, you can't. And that's what we have here with this hemp product right mm-hmm. now. And locally, our Attorney General Chris Mays put out this advisory, basically. And it was asked for by the current House Speaker, Steve Montenegro, and Senator T.J. Shope. And they don't like the situation with this unregulated hemp product coming in. And of course, voters did approve these laws that are supposed to keep it to the dispensaries. So the AG put out this message basically saying that intoxicating hemp products are illegal in Arizona and mostly focused on Delta-8, though, and not Delta-9. But clearly, Delta-9 is an intoxicating product. In fact, it's the most intoxicating. So when I called the AG's office and asked, what are you doing about Total Wine? They're saying, well, we're still thinking about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So any chance, Ray, looking forward here, we will see some regulation of this, maybe legalization of it in some way in Arizona?
We could this year see quite a bit of regulation, a new regulation on the hemp and marijuana front. In the state legislature, there's interest by people like Senator T.J. Shope, who was against the hemp market recently, but told me that since he talked to Total Wine, he's kind of understanding that this is a product that can be tested and safe for the public. So he's considering possible legislation for that. And so we may see this hemp products market regulated. And then there's also the fact that the federal government is considering changing the schedule process of marijuana. So it's a Schedule 1 controlled drug right now. They want to go to Schedule 3, and the DEA has to approve this, basically. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be hearings this year. If that happens, then people will be able to use credit cards and things like that at the dispensaries where they've been using cash. And the dispensaries themselves can start taking advantage of these tax deductions that they haven't been able to do. So they'll make more money. There'll still be this oversupply. So I've been told that the prices shouldn't go down for consumers, even if the dispensaries start making more money just because of these different regulation changes.
Okay. All right. Lots to watch for. Ray Stern, Arizona Republic reporter, joining us to talk more about it. Ray, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
The incoming Trump administration is expected to prioritize legislation focused on trans people. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
President-elect Trump is preparing to take the oath of office with majorities in both the House and the Senate. In December, during a speech at America Fest here in Phoenix, Trump said that under his administration, quote, it will be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. Statements like that are terrifying for many trans Americans, and there's been plenty of concern about the legislative implications of Trump's second term for their community. Orion Rumler is a reporter for the 19th, and he's been reporting on a series of bills working their way through Congress that specifically target trans people. As Rumler told me recently, Republican lawmakers seem to have two primary areas of focus: restricting access to gender-affirming care, and a bill that would make changes to Title IX, the federal civil rights law prohibiting sex discrimination in schools.
It wants to amend how schools are in compliance with Title IX to say, if a school allows a trans girl who's a student to play on women's sports, that school is no longer in compliance with Title IX, which threatens the funding for that school.
And when it comes to gender-affirming care, what do those pieces of legislation look like? What is the aim of those bills?
The aim of those bills is to revoke federal funds from hospitals that provide gender-affirming care.
For folks who are listening and who may not know from a practical standpoint what we mean when we say gender-affirming care, what procedures, what drugs, what does that refer to?
So for trans youth, gender-affirming care means puberty blockers ahead of when they would enter puberty.
Right.
They go with their parents to receive that care, and then later on, they may choose to take hormone replacement therapy, which would mean estrogen or testosterone.
Right. And the effects of these restrictions, if enacted, even though they're at the federal level, would still have a palpable effect at the local level, right?
Oh, yeah. Revoking federal funds for gender-affirming care, that would cut gender transition care for people who receive Medicaid or a subsidized plan under the Affordable Care Act. Every hospital needs federal funds to survive. And so if you look at a specific state, Illinois is one example. The Chicago Tribune has a great story out about this, where doctors in Illinois are aware of these threats to revoke federal funding from hospitals that are providing this care. What doctors in Illinois were saying is, you know, we would have to make a choice between providing this care and getting funding, and the choice would be to keep getting funding. Like, it's not a real choice.
Right, right. And the Medicaid example that you cited is particularly important here too, right? Because a disproportionately large number of trans people rely on Medicaid for health insurance, correct?
Yeah, so 1 in 5 transgender adults are covered through Medicaid. And some of the context there is because of systemic discrimination. A lot of trans people in the U.S. have incomes under $50,000 per year or unemployed. And so those disparities are some of what fuels that need to access Medicaid, which is,
right,
you know, meant for low-income folks.
Can you talk a little bit about what would happen to folks whose care is disrupted in the event that some of this legislation is passed?
I'm glad you asked. Like, if a trans man is taking testosterone and suddenly stops, some of the side effects are going to feel like going through menopause, mm-hmm. but very quickly. And hormones regulate just a lot of your body, like physically and emotionally. You know, it's just really not advised to suddenly stop, like, taking these hormones, which a lot of trans people, like you're saying, like, would be faced with that prospect if they just don't have any other option and they can't afford to get it out of pocket.
Right. So what are you seeing from congressional Democrats in terms of whether or not they'll be supportive of these efforts? Because even though Republicans will control the entire government, their margins in both the House and the Senate are pretty slim. So is there any indication that Democrats are going to be willing to resist this legislation?
So to me, it's actually not clear if they will resist it. And so far, one of the only examples we can point to where Democrats have compromised on trans rights or a trans policy was in like a must-pass bill to fund the federal government.
Right. In the $1.2 trillion spending package to fund the federal government through the 2024 fiscal year, there was this provision included that would ban U.S. embassies from flying the Pride flag. That example does stick out to me because it strikes me that when it comes to things like gender-affirming care or women's sports, Republicans, if they were so inclined, could ostensibly use science as a kind of a smokescreen to deny that there's any ideological motivation behind a bill related to those things. But a policy about a flag is different. To me, that would sort of suggest that Republicans are feeling emboldened to say, we just don't like the idea of queer and trans people, and we don't want the U.S. to be associated with that.
Oh, yeah. Even just in the Title IX sports bill that was reintroduced this week, like whenever Republicans in Congress are talking about that bill, they're talking about sports, but what they're really talking about is that they believe that trans women are biologically male. Like that's the core belief behind this piece of legislation, is we don't believe trans women are women.
Right. A lot of these legislative efforts that we're talking about align with rhetoric that we've seen from Donald Trump, but he also seems to have his own agenda when it comes to trans issues and things he wants to do with or without the legislative support of Congress. Tell us what he has in mind.
He wants the Justice Department to, quote, investigate big pharma and hospital networks to figure out if they have, how he phrases it, covered up side effects of gender-affirming care or illegally marketed hormones and puberty blockers.
Right. So in my memory, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this wasn't really a priority for Trump and or congressional Republicans during Trump's first term. And now all of a sudden it seems to be close to the center of their priorities. Do we have a sense of what has changed? Why this is suddenly such a source of apparent concern for them?
I'm sure that they watched the state-level anti-trans policies proliferate over the past couple of years. I mean, during the Biden administration, so many states have been, and state-level Republicans have been introducing these bills, and a lot of the rhetoric revolves around protecting kids, protecting women, protecting the sanctity of the family. There was an Iowa governor who said knowing boys from girls was as vital as knowing the difference between liberty and tyranny. There is a Republican candidate for attorney general in Nevada who called for fewer trans people to exist. I believe she lost her race. So I'm not suggesting that this rhetoric was doing folks favors. I haven't, like, politically, but it Republicans at these tables have become more and more emboldened to use it to get attention to their races. And if we know one thing about Trump is that he does love attention. And so, you know, to me, that would be part of why this is part of his strategy.
Well, Orion Rumler is a reporter for The 19th covering LGBTQ plus issues. Orion, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. E-books are becoming more and more popular, and many readers like to get them from their local libraries. But in communities across the country, that's causing problems for those libraries. Caitlin Schmidt, editor and publisher at Tucson Spotlight, has been looking into the situation in Pima County, and she joins me to talk about it. And Caitlin, what are libraries there finding in terms of the popularity of e-books? It seems like they're becoming maybe more popular than checking out actual physical books.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that. And this year or last year in 2024, digital loans, which are ebooks and audiobooks and that stuff, outpaced physical loans by about 2.8 million to about 2.2. So a little more than 500,000 more checkouts for digital this year.
And this is causing, it sounds like, some financial concerns for those libraries in the sense that ebooks can in some ways be more expensive for those libraries to get, right?
Yes, they are almost always more expensive for libraries to get. The American Library Association reported that libraries pay about $55 for a copy of an ebook for use for 2 years, whereas you or I could purchase that same ebook for perpetual use for like $15. So they really mark them up and they limit the time use. And some publishers are also limiting the number of times that can be checked out. So with HarperCollins, for example, after 26 loans, the ebook essentially self-destructs and the library has to purchase it all over again at whatever price it's at that point in time, which actually could be more.
Well, so how are the libraries trying to deal with this? Because as we discussed, the popularity of this kind of book is going up, but so is the cost.
Yeah. So they found themselves having to cap checkouts at certain times, both in terms of holds and how many e-copies you can download at a time. And I think, awareness is something else they're trying to do. I will admit, prior to my interview with the library, I had been guilty of checking out audiobooks on my Libby app and maybe not finishing them and letting them lapse. And now that I know that that costs the library every time and that's a hit against them, I won't be doing that anymore. I'm actually buying my ebooks and audiobooks now. So I think getting the word out to people that, hey, they're not paying the same price that we are, and they also don't get to use them forever, I think is key.
Yeah, what does the library and what do librarians say about whether or not this model is sustainable? Like at some point, are they just going to have to say to people, look, if you want to read this on your Kindle or on an app, you're just going to have to buy it yourself?
I think people that work in the library space are really dedicated to making sure that libraries continue to be a place of equity. So I think that's going to be a move of last resort. But what we are seeing here in Pima County, and we heard about last August, is that the libraries don't have enough staff for all of their physical locations anymore. And so they're talking about cutting down hours and closing them. And so, I think the move to a digital space is really impacting them all over. Libraries are still a gathering place, but they also need to be able to pay for their services, and that's including the ebooks. So they didn't have any firm plans about what they're doing. Right now, Pima County Library spends about 50% of their material budgets on ebooks versus physical books, whereas a lot of other libraries are at 60% for digital books. So not sure what's going to happen with us with that one just yet.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a situation, and again, if the library hasn't quite figured out what their plan is, but I wonder if, for most libraries, if not all, you have a certain number of books you can check out at a time, physical books. I wonder if maybe libraries are thinking about saying, okay, each user, each library card holder can, check out X number of maybe ebooks or digital copies per quarter, per year, something like that, as a way to, as you say, make sure that these libraries continue to be places of equity where everybody has some kind of access to the materials that they want.
Right. Yeah. And right now they cap, our library at least caps how many you can have checked out at a time. But, you can have X number, 10, 20 checked out at a time for the entire year. So it would make more sense to move to a model of you can check out 4 titles a month or 18 titles a year or something like that.
Yeah. Is this the kind of thing that some communities, some library systems have already figured out that, for example, the Pima County Library could look to, Community X and say, okay, this is what they're doing and it seems to be working. Maybe we could adopt something like that?
They certainly can. And I think that there's a lot of research going on in that space. Libraries across the United States and here in Pima County, too, are in a little bit of crisis. When that draft report leaked in August about their plans to close some libraries, the community here really was up in arms about it. And so they backed off and started some public input. So I think they're doing a lot of research about what's being done in other communities and what they can possibly do to keep offering the same level of service that they have in the past. But I think this digital loan thing just really crept up on everyone. They told me that prior to the pandemic, digital loans made up about 16% of their checkouts. And now it's more than 50% in a really short amount of time. So I don't think any of the libraries knew how to handle this surge.
Yeah. Well, does it seem as though there's any hope for some kind of compromise maybe between publishers and libraries to reduce the cost in some way to make them more cost effective for libraries to have?
It actually does not seem like that's going to happen. There was just a lawsuit that four major publishers filed against the Internet Archive for a practice called controlled digital lending. Pima County Library wasn't doing this, but a lot of other libraries were, and that allowed them to scan physical copies of the books that it had in its possession, and they could lend those out on a one-to-one ratio. So if somebody wanted to check out the digital copy of that CDL book, they would pull the physical copy from circulation, and then vice versa the same way. But it just went all the way up to the Second Circuit, who sided with publishers and said that that's not fair use. So libraries can no longer scan and lend out books that they physically own anymore. So it seems like this was a backstep, and it does not seem like publishers want to make this any easier on libraries.
So you spoke with the director of Pima County Public Libraries. I mean, what does she say they're looking at? What does she say they're maybe looking to do? I mean, because as we've talked about, like, this current model does not seem like it can last forever.
Right. You know, I mean, this is, they're in a look and see pattern right now with all things at the Pima County Library. And I think that this digital loan space is just one of the areas they're looking at. I think their priority right now is to figure out how to not close branches, even though some of these libraries really need some serious like structural repair work. I know that the downtown branch has issues with the elevator. It's so old, they can't even buy the parts for it anymore. So I think, unfortunately, digital loans are not at the front of their mind, but, you know, I think they're going to have to deal with it. I'm in a few book clubs, and most people bring their Kindles with them or their phones these days instead of the physical copies of books. And a lot of people that I know are checking them out from the library. So I hope that they can find something that's happening in another community, or maybe get the word out and have people donate money to a digital loan fund or something. But I mean, these prices are just exorbitant. An ebook for you or I from HarperCollins would cost $14. And for the library, it's $68. So, I mean, way, way up.
All right. That is Caitlin Schmidt, editor and publisher of Tucson Spotlight. Caitlin, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Late last year, just under the deadline, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took an important step toward putting the monarch butterfly on the endangered species list. It's an important move that's been a long time coming. The initial petition to do it came out more than a decade ago, and population numbers have only continued their decline since. Kim Pegram leads the Desert Botanical Garden's Pollinator Conservation and Research Program and has been working to get the public engaged in helping these beloved butterflies. I spoke with her more about this latest move and if it could be enough to save them.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has determined, with the data that we have available, that there is a high risk of extinction in the near future, which in this particular instance means the next 60 years, and that they need additional protection if we are going to have a chance of saving them.
Wow. Okay. So what would those protections look like? How would this sort of official status change their situation?
So listing for every species looks a little bit different. And for monarchs that are so beloved, and a lot of people do their own conservation work, you know, planting milkweed in their backyard, this is not going to affect that kind of thing. They've made the protections more focused on particularly the overwintering habitat in California. That's where the western monarchs, they spend the winter in these groves along the coast of California, and there's extra protection now for those groves. Additionally, it'll affect federal projects or projects that may have federal input or federal funding. They might evaluate those projects for potential disruption to monarch habitat. But for your everyday, you know, backyard, any of those kinds of things are not affected by these new protections.
And there at the Desert Botanical Garden, you've been working for a long time to preserve the monarch butterfly here in Arizona. And it's been like a decade since the initial petition to make this happen came out. What has the situation looked like in the meantime with the monarch butterfly? Like, how much worse has it gotten?
So the population numbers are still showing a decline. We've had some bad years. Monarch population numbers are measured based on the overwintering sites. So there are people doing counts in the overwintering sites in California and people measuring them in Mexico. And that's the way that we track the population from year to year. And overall, they're still showing a pretty steady decline with those populations. So the last status update from Fish and Wildlife was 5 years ago when they said the data warranted listing them, but you know, there were other priorities and they had to make a decision within 2024. So they made this decision in December that the monarch will be listed a year from then, so December 2025. After, you know, this year period of reviewing the potential restrictions, and there's a public comment period as well.
Okay. So tell us why. Like, what are the causes? Why are monarch butterflies looking at this kind of dire future?
There's a lot of reasons we think they are probably declining. Habitat decline is one of the leading reasons. So monarchs need milkweed as their host plant. That's what the female butterflies seek out milkweed to lay their eggs on, and it's the only plant their caterpillars can eat. Mm-hmm. So as milkweed has gone away from our natural fields, as you know, as lands are developed, we've lost a lot of milkweed habitat. We've also lost a lot of nectar habitat. Those are the plants that provide food for the adult butterflies that, you know, provide nectar through flowers. We've lost a lot of that habitat as well. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's one of the leading drivers of decline.
Right. And that's a big part of your efforts at the Desert Botanical Garden to plant milkweed, to get people to plant it in their yards, right? Just a very simple thing.
Right. Yes. That is one of the best things about working on monarchs and talking to people about monarchs is that everybody can help monarchs. It's really easy to do. You can provide that habitat, just like I was talking about. You can provide milkweeds, you can provide nectar plants, and all of that has the potential to affect the long-term survival of monarch butterflies.
Is it enough? Like, can we as a public do enough at this point to save this beloved species?
So in my line of work, I have to be optimistic. Mm-hmm. I am optimistic that there is a groundswell of support. There are so many people that are interested and invested. Even the amount of acres that have been, large amounts of land that have been devoted to monarch habitat just in the last 5 years since the last update is really incredible. And so I really think there is a chance. And it's important to remember that this isn't just about the monarch, that monarchs are what we have good numbers for, but there's probably a lot of other species that are suffering similar declines, a lot of other, you know, butterflies and pollinators. And so, but everybody can help. Everybody can plant milkweed and nectar plants in their yard, patios, wherever you have space available.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like this could have real implications if the monarch butterfly is put on the endangered species list. Do you think that will play a big role in that optimism that you have to keep going?
Yes, I think adding habitat is going to be really important. And the listing doesn't affect people's ability to do that. That was one of the things that we were worried about before this proposed listing decision came out, is that because the monarch has so much support from everybody, whether it's planting habitat, we've got community science, we've got people tagging butterflies or, you know, recording butterflies, even, you know, with pictures, all of that. Because there is so much everyday support behind monarchs, we wanted to make sure that wasn't impacted by the Fish and Wildlife decision. Mm. And from everything we can tell reading the listing decision, it's not. And so that's important, is that all of that work can go forward. And we also have the protection in these critical habitat overwintering sites in California.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly, Kim, I mean, like, what do you love about monarch butterflies? You must be pretty passionate about this to do this every day.
So I'm passionate about butterflies and pollinators in general. I do enjoy working with monarchs, but the biggest thing for me is that monarchs capture the imagination for a lot of people. It's the one butterfly. If you know a butterfly, you know monarchs. And so I like that by getting everybody behind the monarch, that we are helping all the other species too. It inspires so many. And that's a big part of the reason that I work on monarchs.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Kim Pegram, Program Director of Pollinator Conservation and Research at the Desert Botanical Garden here in Phoenix. Kim, thank you for coming back on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, if you can follow us on Instagram, maybe some photos of monarchs up there. Who
Ooh,
knows?
I hope so. They're so beautiful.
They really are.
Yeah.
That's KJZZ, the show, at KJZZ, the show on Instagram. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.